Welcome in to Late Night Baseball. Thanks everyone for joining us. We are happy that you're here this week to talk ball. Parker, how are you feeling this evening?
Red Sox got rained out, which means I get to watch a doubleheader tomorrow, which is awesome. I'm off work, so I get to just spend a whole day watching two baseball games. It's going to be fun. Hate the fact that the rain out did happen, though. Was looking forward to watching some ball. But I'm good, man. I've been in a really Star Wars mood lately. I got the hat going. I've been playing Star Wars Outlaws. Well, okay. So I go through phases. Like, I do definitely go through, like I'm always into Star Wars, but right now I'm fucking obsessed with Star Wars. I'm playing Star Wars Outlaws right now. And if you haven't played that game, it's incredible.
Oh, man. It's so good. I wish I knew what the phases thing felt like. It's just one long phase that never ever ends.
Started in 1977.
That's exactly right. Before I was even an idea or a thought, it was ingrained in me. I'm sorry, by the way, that my studio has just been like I was absolutely robbed of all my Star Wars stuff. I'm doing remodeling here. So for those of you watching, they're like, what the hell happened to all of Anthony's stuff? Did he get robbed? No, I'm redoing this space. So calm down. Thank you for your concern.
Jay Hay showed up. He liked your setup. He was, and he came and he stole all your stuff because he thought it was cool.
If he's coming over and taking my stuff, I will willingly give him a souvenir.
If you guys didn't watch it, the Jay Hay like bonus episode / interview / everything was so fun.
It was fun.
It was like a week in the making between scheduling and getting him on, and it was a lot of fun to do. So if you haven't watched it, definitely go over there and watch that. He's awesome, and he had a lot of really good insight. So
yeah, for sure. And definitely if you haven't caught Baseball is Dead, make sure you're doing that too. Part of the Underdog
after you're done with the entire episode of this show.
Correct. There is a prerequisite to that request. Parker, I gotta say, man, I'm really excited to talk baseball this week, mainly because we're getting to that kind of magic date in the baseball calendar. It's a tale as old as time. You kind of know what teams look like by Memorial Day. It's a good kind of barometer, litmus test, if you will, for kind of knowing what a team's going to be like for the remainder of the year, which means it's a good time to look at the standings. And Parker, there's actually teams that are starting to break away a bit here. And it's kind of exciting.
Yeah. I mean, we've got 5-game leads in the AL East, AL Central, 3.5-game lead for the Mariners. NL East has stayed relatively close. The Mets are still 2 games away from the Phillies, which is interesting because the Mets are 10 games above 500 and they're still 2 games back of the Phillies. So like that division is as competitive as we kind of thought it was going to be. Cubs have separated themselves by 3 games over the Cardinals, and the Dodgers, interestingly enough, are only 2 games up on the Giants. The Giants that you said I was crazy for thinking would be a good team this year, by the way.
I still think you're nuts, and I think that is going to be a short-lived experience. So we'll talk about that at some point.
Yeah, I do have a little – we didn't throw it in the rundown, but I do have a Dodgers point to bring up, albeit briefly, later on.
Cool. Well, Parker, I got to ask you about something that occurred at a recent – Red Sox game, an injection that involved Walker Buehler and Alex Cora. Admittingly, I heard about it. I have not seen any footage. I'm coming into this completely blind. So tell me what the hell happened.
All right. So a little bit of backstory on the whole thing. Walker Buehler, he's been down for his last 2 or 3 starts. He was on the 15-day IL. He had some shoulder stuff going on, bursitis. Made his comeback, made a couple of rehab starts, and finally made his comeback against the Mets on Tuesday. Now he was 2 1/3 innings in. Francisco Lindor gets on. He steals second. On the pitch was basically right down the middle. I don't have that queued up, but you'll see here in a second. The pitch was almost right down the middle. I believe it's in the clip I'm about to show you. But regardless, Mike Estabrook, who is the home plate umpire, called it a ball. Buehler didn't really get the call as the play, like the action of the stolen base was happening. So then after the call at second base, Buehler looks at the home plate umpire and asks for the count. And Estabrook says it's 0-2. And then Buehler was like, wait, no strikes. Or excuse me, not 0-2. He said it's 2-0. And Buehler said, wait, no strikes. Like, buddy, that was right down the middle. And Estabrook Well, let me just show you the clip. Let me show you exactly what happened. So, in my opinion, Easterbrook unnecessarily escalates this situation. Here, let me go back to the beginning so I'm not spoiling anything. Unnecessarily escalates this situation, and it leads to the ejection of the Red Sox starting pitcher less than three innings into the game. So here we go. Okay, so I want to ask you something, and I'm going to rewind this video so you can see it. Where is Walker Buehler standing during this brief exchange?
It looked like he was standing on the mound.
Where is he standing?
He's right there on the mound, walking up to the mound.
Okay, so Walker Buehler was immediately ejected following this, and I'm going to keep it on screen so we can see. So he was ejected. He said, buddy, that was right down the middle. I think he led with, buddy, that was right down the fucking middle. Buddy, that was right down the middle. He repeated himself. Mike Easterbrook, the reason the camera pans away is because you're watching the ump cam, and Mike Easterbrook takes his mask off, walks past the dirt cut on the field, and points at Walker Buehler and says, like, we're not doing this, or whatever the hell he said to him. Walker then goes, like, no, you're not going to talk to me that way. That was right down the middle, and then proceeds to be ejected by Mike Easterbrook. We're arguing balls and strikes. Now, I get that. Sure, he said fuck to the umpire, but that's, like, not totally taboo, especially not for a veteran, a guy, Walker Buehler, who just won a World Series last year. He's been around for 7 years. He's, you know, he's not new to the game.
Right.
And in an interview after the game, the crew chief, so the way that umpire interviews goes, that the crew chief just addresses the media, if necessary, to a pool reporter. And in that interview, Laz Diaz, the crew chief, says Walker Buehler was arguing balls and strikes, and he left his position to argue balls and strikes, which anytime you leave your position, you're going to be ejected. Walker's standing on the mound. Walker is standing on the mound, and Easterbrook walks toward him, removes his mask, points at him, and escalates the situation artificially, and then proceeds to toss the starting pitcher. In my opinion, that's completely out of line. This is Walker's first start back from injury. People bought a ticket to watch him pitch, not to watch the umpire throw somebody out of the game. And, like, there's more to the story. Like, there's a lot of people who are like, why is Alex Cora not getting out of the dugout faster? Because normally what happens is either the catcher or the manager will kind of just, like, get in between the two and get tossed instead of the pitcher. That way somebody pays the price, but the pitcher can continue to pitch and doesn't completely screw the bullpen of the team in question. So because it was a stolen base on the pitch, Alex Cora was looking at his replay analyst, waiting for the, like, let's keep it going, or the, you know, challenge the play. So he didn't notice what was going on until basically Walker was already tossed. Cora comes out, he gets tossed. I'm not really worried about the Cora ejection, because at that point he kind of, like, came out with the intention of getting tossed from the game to make it known, like, this is unacceptable, in my opinion. So there's a lot of layers to this. I personally am just, I'm in the like, this is a welcome to the ump show moment. Like, why are we tossing the pitcher when he didn't leave the mound? He's allowed to say he doesn't agree with the ball or strike call, and you artificially escalated the situation.
Yeah, I mean, you see this every so often with these umpires, right? I mean, they have those power trip moments, and you never like to see it. It gets kind of annoying. I would love to see that pitch, right? I want to go back and look at where that previous pitch was, honestly.
I'm telling you, it was down the dick. Like, it was.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I can try to find it.
If that's the case, I get why Walker gets upset. Like you said, throwing F-bombs on the ballpark and on the field, not taboo. It happens. It just seems like this is a case of an umpire being a little too sensitive and having a little bit of a power trip and wanting to show Walker who's boss. I think that's what it comes down to.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's pretty interesting to see. Yeah. Okay. So the game day, I'm going to pull this up real quick and show you the game day, like the MLB app also, like will show where the pitch was. It's not necessarily down the dick, but it is a like this is a big league call that you have to make. So let me go ahead and share my window one more time.
This will be interesting. Okay, let's see. Okay, that's a that's you gotta not make that even call. Really a borderline. That's not a borderline, right? You gotta make that call.
And regardless of whether it is borderline or not, like Walker has a point. Like he's a vet. He's been around. He knows what a strike looks like. He executed his pitch properly, and has a right to be kind of bent out of shape about it.
Yeah, that sucks. I can see where he's coming from. Yikes. Wow.
Yeah, for sure. So well, that's how that happened. It had follow-on effects. The Red Sox bullpen was completely toast for the next two games after that because they had to pitch, you know, seven innings in relief after that. After that ejection. So,
well, it wasn't the first and certainly won't be the last if we see something like that. Speaking of this whole situation, the guy in the box – during this scenario was Juan Soto and Parker, you know, don't get me wrong. The Mets have something going on, right? 30-20. Mm-hmm. I will say it's been a rough 10 days for them. They're 5-5 over the last 10 games. So they've started to slow down a little bit, but you know, it'd be great for them is to get something more out of Juan Soto, and Juan Soto just has not been it. And we're getting to Memorial Day. I mean,
He hasn't been Juan Soto, right?
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, he hasn't been an $800 million player. He hasn't been terrible. I'd be happy to have him on my team, sort of, to a certain extent. But right now this year, he is, you know, he still has a 130 OPS plus. He's an 800 OPS, 8 home runs, but it's only a 243 batting average. His on-base percentage, which is like the Juan Soto calling card. It's the thing that gets him MVP votes, is only a 374. And in the series in New York, the Subway Series, like one of the most anticipated returns in free agent signings that we've seen in recent memory, he went 1-for-10 and walked 4 times and like didn't play great defense and didn't really hustle at all. There's a couple plays where like one play defensively, he let a ball bounce in the corner that he absolutely could have gotten to. Another one where he grounded out to second base and could have made it a very close play if not beat it out for a base hit and just wasn't hustling out of the box at all. And I don't have the clips queued up, but like he was visibly playing catch significantly closer to the bench than he typically does because he was trying not to play catch closer to the fans before each inning because he was, you know, trying to stay away from the fans. And, you know, I don't know. It seems like a situation where he wasn't ready to play into the whole, this is the Juan Soto return to the Bronx scenario, which stinks because I think as fans, we want to juice that kind of thing up. But like, I expected him to be like a dog let off the leash during this series. And I think that's kind of just not what anybody got. Not to mention the Mets lose 2 out of those 3 games.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think when I talk about kind of we're not getting the same Juan Soto, it's really been over the last 10 games. You know, you're right. Yeah. He's not terrible by any stretch of the imagination, but I do worry about what we've seen in the last 10 games. Last 10 games, he has a WRC plus of 51. He's batting 143 over the last 10 games. So it hasn't been a great stretch for Juan Soto. Every ball player goes through a stretch like this, of course. Having said that, you kind of said it in the beginning here, is the Phillies. I think we all came into this season and certainly the first half or so of April had some concerns about the Phillies, but there they are back at it. Right. And, you know, leading that division, they always find a way, those damn Phillies. And if the Mets think that they can just coast like they seemingly did all April with getting lucky with their rotation, I think that's going to run out here soon with a strong Phillies team.
Yeah, absolutely. The Phillies are weird. Like, I think still that this is like the prove it season for the Phillies. They have to be good this season. They have to win a World Series this season, in my opinion, to finally justify all of this era of Phillies baseball with, you know, Bryce Harper, Trey Turner, JT Realmuto, Nick Castellanos, Kyle Schwarber, like a lineup of absolute terrors for anybody who's going to be going up against them. The problem that we're seeing right now with the Phillies, and they've outperformed this, is that guys that you need production from are just not giving you that production. Like Alec Bohm has so far sort of gotten to the point where he's not a detriment so much to the team, but it is a 660 OPS plus because of how bad he's been prior to this most recent stretch. He is a negative five WAR. It's pretty bad. Max Kepler has not necessarily been the addition that we thought and maybe hoped he would be at a half a WAR added this season and a 704 OPS. And then Johan Rojas with his 657 OPS. Like this lineup is relying on a guy like Bryce Harper, Kyle Schwarber, Trey Turner to carry a lineup that really needs more production from other places. And, you know, their pitching rotation is going to pitch. Like Jesus Luzardo he's absolutely nuts. Zach Wheeler is, of course, absolutely nuts, but he's 35 and could get hurt any day now. So it's all kind of on a knife's edge in the NL East right now. The Phillies currently just are the ones balancing on it, and we're going to see how that shapes out over the course of the rest of the season.
Yeah, we'll certainly see. This is, like we said,
I forgot. We didn't even put it in the rundown, but we have to talk about Jose Alvarado.
Oh, PED suspension. That's right. Okay. Yes. So this is a perfect spot to do that. Now that we're talking about the Phillies. So yes. So, Jose Alvarado suspended 80 games for PEDs, which this is, I can't really think of the last time. It's been a little while since we've had an in-season suspension for a major league player for PED. So this is pretty significant, and it's significant because it's one of the Phillies' better starters, a starter that now will not see the light of day for the rest of the season, certainly into the postseason. So this is, I would say, Parker, it's a hit that the Phillies took that they really, from a bullpen standpoint, can't afford to take a hit on right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I also just want to point out that this Jose Alvarado suspension, he's saying he took it as a weight loss supplement during the offseason. He's taking supplemental testosterone. Like, he tested positive for a supplemental testosterone, which, that's a weird thing to take as a weight loss supplement.
It is. Having said that, I'll add another layer to this. Is like these players now, the rules. Like your trainers, your whoever you're working with, like you have a personal responsibility, and they have responsibility to know what you're putting in your body. Like guys, this is we're too old for this shit. We've gone through this too many times. We should know what's in these things. This shouldn't really be a surprise. Like, come on.
Yeah, this isn't like a tangential substance either. Like, this isn't like a, this is somewhat, because there are, let's be very clear, there are authorized performance enhancing substances. You are allowed to crack yourself out on caffeine if you're a closer and slam through Red Bull before you go out there. Like, that's fine. Totally fine. In fact, I would expect you to do so. But when you're on like a program of exogenous testosterone, like literally TRT, those of you who are in like bodybuilding or athletic, I guess like a more exercise centric athletic competition, like things like CrossFit and stuff like that, you would know, like, this is something you're going to get popped for and you're going to get suspended for. It seems like a very blatant violation of the performance enhancing drug policy, which sucks because Jose Alvarado is, he's 30 years old. He had a 2.70 ERA at the time of suspension. He had pitched 20 innings with 7 saves for the Phillies, and like is a big part of that bullpen and one of the more prominent left-handed closers in baseball. So like,
yeah, absolutely.
With a 1.83 FIP, he was shoving. I don't know. It sucks. It's a big loss.
It is a big loss. They don't have really any strong numbers out of that bullpen right now. Lowest ERA is Matt Strom out of the left-hand side. He's at 2.89 ERA. Jordan Romano has a high 7.27 ERA. I suspect that'll come down throughout the year. I think that's just the result of some bad games because his K per nine's at 10. So that's just a high mark for him this season. But outside of Romano and Strom, the rest is really just question marks. So if you're going to here's what I'll say. I'm going to make this very, very cold take. I especially with Alvarado suspended, I think the Phillies are going to be one of the bigger players for relief pitching at the trade deadline for more than one arm.
I would imagine. Matt Strom, I think, is going to slide right into that closer role, most likely. Jordan Romano also being a candidate for that, too. But Matt Strom, like you pointed out, is absolutely shoving as well. It's a 1.9 FIP. It's a 1.45 ERA plus. He's probably the next guy, especially because he slots in that lefty closer position. But, I mean, yeah, I don't know. Big loss for the Phillies, but let's see how they do. This started as a Mets conversation, turned into a Phillies conversation. But that NL East is going to be interesting, especially if the Braves, like, they took two out of three from the Red Sox, which, I mean, anybody, I think, at this point could take two out of three from the Red Sox. But the Braves are and have begun to dig themselves out of the hole they created for themselves at the beginning of the season. And if they can really get it going, then this division becomes very, very interesting very, very quickly.
It sure does, because, folks, let's not forget, Ronald Acuna is coming back. Yep. Spencer Strider already back, right? So if those two guys come back and they're hot off the presses and they can contribute anything to that team, wow, won't we all be really dumb when we were giving them shit in April?
Yeah. And I mean, we always talk about how baseball is this game of, like, getting hot at the right time. Nothing is more evident of that right now than this NL East, where the Phillies went on a 7-game win streak at the same exact time that the Mets decided to go 5-5 over their last 10. They lost two series straight to the Yankees and the Red Sox. So, like, I don't know. This is what we say about baseball. You got to get hot at the right time.
You do. You absolutely do. Parker, I was obviously looking up news like we usually do every day because we're just knee deep in it all the time, and was really excited to see Kershaw earlier this week. It was off the IL and making his first start of the season. I think you and I are big Kershaw guys, and it got me thinking. And we've like covered this in the past, like slightly. I've been thinking about kind of the big three guys right now that are at the end of their careers and they're most likely going to retire together. I'm talking Clayton Kershaw, Justin Verlander, Max Scherzer. Three of the best pitchers of the game, certainly in the twilight of their career. They're certainly now, all three of them, not throwing what they were throwing even 2 years ago. But Parker, like, I want to play a game with you because I want people to realize, like, how unique this is that we have three generational pitchers that are going to be retiring, all three of them hands down Hall of Famers. But the fact that it's happening at the same time is pretty significant. So, Parker, before I give you a chance to talk about this, I want to play a game with you. I pulled some stats with these three guys, and I was actually quite shocked with what I found. I pulled all-time WAR stats, and I pulled all-time K per nine. Okay, so what I want to know from you is minimum 2,000 innings pitched in their career as a starting pitcher. That's the filter I use. All-time WAR. Where do you think, if you had a guess, Verlander, Kershaw, and Scherzer would be on that list?
All-time WAR. In relation to each other, I think I would put Kershaw above the rest of them and then Scherzer, then Verlander. But I couldn't give you a position. Like, I'm trying to think. I would say they're top, all of them, top 25.
That is a really good guess. That's a really good guess. So Verlander, 17th all time with 82.2 WAR. Kershaw, 25th all time with 76.3, and Scherzer right behind at 28th all time at 72.9.
Okay.
That three pitchers that are pitching today that are in the top 30 all time WAR is pretty significant. Now, just the tip of the iceberg. I took it a step further. I was like, I got to see K per nine because you know what? It's all about the strikeouts now. If you had to rank these guys, just them, in order of their K per nine without looking at it, which order would you have them in?
Scherzer, Verlander, Kershaw.
Close. Scherzer, Kershaw, Verlander.
Really?
Now, yes, now I'll make this even more interesting for you, Parker. Verlander all time has the 7th K per 9 all time at 897.
Mm-hmm.
Kershaw has the 4th highest K per 9 at 973. Scherzer, number one. All time with 1066 K per 9. Like, guys, we have to understand how significant that is, because you look at all-time war leader, it's your boy, Roger Clemens, okay?
Yeah.
You look at all-time K per 9 leaders, who's up there with Max Scherzer? You got Scherzer number one, Randy Johnson number two, Pedro Martinez number three. That's like
Chris
a
Sale up there?
More of pitchers. Chris Sale is not even,
or he's K to walk ratio is the thing he's like.
He would be, yeah, he would probably be K to walk ratio. I don't see him on this list, but this is like Parker. Like, I don't know, there's ever been a time in history where we had these that you could say like I lived during a time where these three pitchers were pitching basically simpatico with each other throughout their careers. It's pretty special what we got to experience.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's super easy to overlook it, especially because even in recent years, I think we've gotten spoiled before this era. The 90s, we had guys like Greg Maddux and then Roger Clemens and Randy Johnson all at the same time. But like,
yes,
this is our today's version of that. And it's happened to kind of like two eras in a row now, but to point out like who are the next three, who, if this is the new norm, right? We have three of these guys at any given time. Who are they now? Who are the next ones? I don't think you can point any out that are like slam dunks. These are who's separating themselves. And I think that in particular illustrates the point. Like, we're talking about three guys here. I think every one of them has won a triple crown. If not, definitely Verlander has won the triple crown. Verlander and Kershaw, not just Cy Young winners, MVP winners. They've won MVPs as starting pitchers who only pitched 35 games at most in a season during the regular season. So like, these are all guys who have won rings. These are all guys who are basically at this point, it seems. Kershaw's, I don't think, a part of that, but Verlander and Scherzer are basically pitching to see who finishes with most strikeouts, it feels like right now, because I think they're within a few of each other for like the all-time strikeout leaderboard at this point. Absolute ace competitors. Like, people forget about how dominant these guys are. Justin Verlander, to me, is legitimately the second coming of Roger Clemens. Like, this guy came back after a Tommy John surgery in his 40s and won a Cy Young Award. Like, we haven't seen...
Yeah,
we haven't seen any performance like that this deep into a career, basically since people were just taking steroids to stay relevant. You know, the people that you compare that performance to are the last three guys I mentioned, which are Roger Clemens, Randy Johnson, Greg Maddux, guys who can still pitch into their 40s with dominance. And it just doesn't happen. I'm not saying that they're super dominant now. I mean, Kershaw, I had it pulled up a second ago, but Kershaw didn't exactly shove in his one outing he's had this season. He pitched four innings. Let me see. I've got his earned runs pulled up. It's four innings, five earned runs. So like, yeah, okay, he got shelled. But he's also providing depth for a Dodgers team that desperately needs it in the rotation right now. And who would you rather have in that room with your starting pitchers than Clayton Kershaw? The answer is nobody.
Oh, no.
Walker Buehler came over to the Red Sox this past offseason and has done nothing but just wax poetic about how amazing it is to be brought up with Clayton Kershaw as your mentor and learning how to compete from him. So, and that just goes, you know, ditto for Verlander and Scherzer.
Absolutely. Your point's a good one. MVP winners that were starting pitchers, only 17 in Major League history. Kershaw and Verlander are two of them, which is...
And in the modern analytically driven era, it is very hard to win an MVP yes. as a starting pitcher. I don't know if we'll see another one if it's not like a, you know, sub two ERA, sub 1.8 ERA kind of season, you know?
Yeah. Is this a good time to bring up Paul Skenes as probably the next person who could do it?
I could see that. I could see Paul Skenes doing it. Yeah. What's his numbers? I haven't looked him up in a while. What are his numbers looking like this season? I think Paul it's Skenes funny because too is
a couple weeks ago we talked about this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's a 2.4 ERA, 2.44 right now. He's got it literally like right below a 10 K per nine, which is, you know, that barometer for, in my opinion, like for a number one, like to have a day, you know, when like teams will tweet out, like it's Chris Sale day, it's Kershaw day, it's Skenes day.
Yeah.
I think it to, right. to like rate that tweet, I think you need to have like in the ballpark of a 10 K per nine. And
sure,
I think he's
sure.
doing that. He's doing it great. He in 2025, Paul Skenes, I want to point out, has a complete game, which is something we did not think we didn't see last year and didn't know if we would see because of how, you know, conservative the Pirates were with his longevity. But we're seeing them start to stretch him out a little bit more. I will say the performance is a little bit down, but that's not even fair because you can't have a 2.14 ERA plus for your entire career. It's only a 1.73 ERA plus this season. Like, he's still nails and for a yeah. really bad Pirates team. So kudos to him.
Parker, I want to use the large chunk of our time tonight talking about the Baltimore Orioles. They're kind of stealing the spotlight in Major League Baseball right now for all the wrong reasons. They recently, of course, what was that, 3-4 days ago now, let go of their manager, Brandon Hyde. Brandon Hyde was, this season was his sixth season managing that team. And everything just doesn't seem to be clicking for them. There's a lot of question marks about what this means for them going forward, particularly this season and beyond. And I kind of wanted to have kind of a come to Jesus conversation about these Baltimore Orioles. First, I want to talk about Brandon Hyde. You know, I said it a little bit in a video that I posted, one of the shorts that I had posted as an immediate reaction to this. Man, Parker, like, managers, it's tough being in baseball and being a manager in these situations, because I think if you're any fan who's followed baseball for a hot minute, you know that the manager has, at the end of the day, minimal impact on a great deal of things. I mean, let's just
like
be
10%,
honest. They're not
right.
10%. Like, they're not, you're not going to get two or three wins or losses either way out of a manager. You're just not going to. It's not a war contributor. But at the end of the day, it's a shitty situation because there's no team on earth, theoretically, that can go, you know, 15-30 in the first 2 months of the season and no one keeps their job, even if it's not your fault, right? What are they going to do? Keep the manager? So it's just, I feel really bad for Brandon Hyde because he is yet another manager that's scapegoated in a situation that is of anyone on him the least in my mind.
Yeah, I think nobody's under, I actually have a friend of mine. His name's Chris. He's a really, really big Orioles fan. And I hit him up after the Brandon Hyde firing. And I was like, yeah, this will totally fix everything, because we all know that it doesn't fix everything. Like, the most recent example would be the Phillies. They fired Joe Girardi and then went on to, you know, be very successful. But they also had a roster that finally decided to perform to its level after Joe yeah. Girardi was fired. The Orioles are filled with very young players that I don't know that Brandon Hyde can do much other than wait for them to figure their shit out. At the end of the day, what's Brandon Hyde going to do to get Adley Rutschman to drag himself out of the slump he's been in for a season and a half now at this point? Jackson Holliday to figure out his swing, Gunnar Henderson to, you know, be the MVP candidate that he was last year. Cedric Mullins is under the contract year. He should have all the motivation he needs. Heston Kerstad's very young. Ryan Mountcastle's a veteran who should know what he's doing. Like, all of this, by the way, did you know Ryan Mountcastle's only 28 years old? I thought he was like 56.
Yeah. But slight to my roundup.
So to my point, I just think it's very weird to put all of the blame on the manager, especially because who's the guy who fires the manager? The general manager, right? Like the president of baseball operations, the super duper baseball guy, or whatever the hell your team calls it. And in reality, if you had to ask me whose fault it was that this is happening, I would put it on Mike Elias before I put it on anybody else, because every single fan knows that Mike Elias did nothing to supplement this roster in the offseason. We said it on the podcast. In our rankings, we tanked the Orioles projections and our personal projections of them because we just didn't know if they had any pitching to bring into this season. Turns out, shocker, they don't. And that's not really surprising to anybody who was paying attention in the offseason, and Orioles fans were. Apparently, Mike Elias wasn't, because he fired his manager, and in my opinion, Mike Elias deserves to be fired. We've kind of been calling for it without saying it over the last few weeks. So for him to, like, scapegoat the manager feels very grimy. Honestly, I feel really bad for Brandon Hyde because he was probably super excited. He probably felt like one of the more job secure managers in baseball coming into last season, where it's like, I've got this plethora of talent. I've got a new ownership group. I'm ready. Give me the pieces and we're going to win several World Series for this city. And now the guy's on the streets looking for a job. So,
you know,
I feel for the guy.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. And I think the Mike Elias conversation is, I think, what we really need to focus on now, because here's the way I view it. Any logical GM, president of baseball operations, chief space cowboy baseball dude, whatever you call him, like anyone in that chair would go, "Wow, damn, I have this really strong group of young hitters, core guys. Like, let me do one of two things. Let me, if I'm putting together a baseball team, try to do something that is challenging, is create a pitching infrastructure that supports developing pitchers. And if I can't do that, well, I can't just rest on my laurels. Then I have to supplement my pitching in other ways." Like, those are literally the only two options. And when you neglect to do both, like Parker, The answers were right in front of them. They didn't need to go out this offseason and sign a Max Fried, a Blake Snell. They didn't need to. And quite frankly, we knew they weren't going to. They weren't gonna do that. But Jesus, there's no reason. We've said this before on this show. There is no reason Garrett Crochet should be in a Red Sox uniform. There's no reason why you couldn't go pick up a Nick Pivetta, Nathan Avaldi.
A Walker Buehler.
Like, two of those guys and a Crochet, and we are not having this conversation. Now, asterisk there. The offense has not been doing what they should be doing. I get that. That's part of it. But for now, let's focus on the pitching. If you had a Walker Buehler, a Nick Pivetta, and a Garrett Crochet, holy crap, everyone's keeping their job and we're not talking about this, right? We're just not.
Especially a team that has so much prospect capital at their disposal. I don't know if you know this, but you do not need a starting roster of 9 19-year-olds that are all ripping and raring to go. You can trade some of those fucking guys. Like, okay, I go back to this past offseason when we started this podcast, which we've been going now for like 30, this is like episode 34 or 35, and so that puts us over the 6 month mark. So I remember talking in the offseason with you, because you were like, what's going to come to Chicago in return for Garrett Crochet? Because the worst kept secret in baseball was that Crochet was on the trade block and he would not be a White Sox come this upcoming season. I remember one of the first things you said was, give me a Kobe Mayo. Give me, you know, some of these Orioles prospects that was the natural progression. It was like, who has the best systems in baseball and can afford a Garrett Crochet? The Red Sox and the Orioles were right up there. I ended up going to the Red Sox, but it really shouldn't have, because as good as, you know, all the prospects that the Red Sox gave to the White Sox for Garrett Crochet, the Orioles have all of that and more to offer. So the offer should have just been countered by the Orioles. You just throw another guy on there, figure out how you have to make that happen. Because if you have Garrett Crochet locked in for like 6-7 years, like the Red Sox do now, on this Orioles team. Now Tomoyuki Sugano does not need to be your ace. Now Zach Eflin does not need to be your ace moving forward. You have a stopgap. Dylan Cease is also somebody that was talked about being able available to be traded for. Didn't actually end up happening. If you up that, it is insane to say. You can still have Jackson Holliday, Gunnar Henderson, and Heston Kjerstad all still on the Orioles and have traded for a Garrett Crochet and a Dylan Cease. You can that is a world that could have existed. And then, like you said, you bring in a Walker Buehler, and this team just looks completely different. It's actually just crazy that Kyle Gibson was brought onto this roster. It's crazy that $15 million is being paid to Charlie Morton to put up a -1.1 WAR and a 7.68 ERA.
So you bring up an equally interesting point. So this is a three-pronged issue, and it's the offense not hitting up to their potential. We covered that. It's the pitching we know that was never reinforced, but also to me, it's also a talent. What am I trying to say? It's a not a talent development, but it's a talent identification issue. Like, I don't know that this front office is good at identifying and scouting talent. And the reason why I say that is because you have these scouts that do, obviously, the amateur folks, you have scouts in the minors, and you have major league scouts, okay? I don't know what the hell these major league scouts are doing, but when you miss on multiple guys, you miss on a Tyler O'Neill, you miss on a Gary Sanchez, you miss on a Charlie Morton and a Kirk Gibson, like, it's either you blatantly missed or you were like, shit, we're out of ideas. We're just going to throw it out there and see if it sticks. Like, it was one of those, and both of those are not winning strategies. Like, they're just not.
What is Tyler O'Neill doing this season? Oh, it's a 76 OPS plus. That stinks. I mean, to their credit, he had 30 bombs last year for the Red Sox, but he was also hitting in Fenway, and then you moved him to the polar opposite, which the left field fence in Camden is like 735 feet away.
I mean, you get a good opening day out of him at least. I mean, you know.
So yeah, exactly. So my only thing that I would counter your point, and I do think it's a really good point. My only comeback to that is I don't think that's necessarily the problem. I think that the problem in this front office is the lack of a desire to part with the prospect capital that you have identified as being very good. So like you said, the amateur level scouting is on point. They know exactly what they're getting, and they've largely been good up to this point. When you have that much money in your bank account, the asking price is going to go up. This isn't Walmart. We're not spending $5 on a box of Fruity Pebbles, because if you walk into Walmart and I walk into Walmart, it's $5 for a box of Fruity Pebbles, no matter who's in there. But in the baseball world, if you are feeding another team a player that you know they need, and you also know that they have the prospect capital to afford that player, the price just kind of climbs ever so slightly. One extra guy, another lottery ticket. And if you're a guy like Mike Elias, and I think this is actually kind of an advantage the Red Sox had in these negotiations, Mike Elias is the guy who brought all this young talent on board. I think he might be a little too close to the problem here, because Craig Breslow did not draft all of this prospect capital the Red Sox sent over to the White Sox. He drafted Braden Montgomery, but he didn't draft Kyle Teal. He was an inheritor of a very good system built by Chaim Bloom. So he didn't really have an attachment to all these guys. It's kind of like, oh, look at all this money that I was given. I can go spend it. Mike Elias drafted all these guys. They are his guys. His stamp is on them. So I think he was just, I think he was really reluctant to make the uncomfortable decision to send those guys out. Because the last thing you want to do, and I don't understand this, because it wasn't the case in the 90s and early 2000s, front offices are petrified of losing trades. Yes. Nobody wants to be the loser in a trade. When back in the day, you just lost trades all the time, but it was the ones that hit that people talked about. But because we have so many numbers and stuff like that surrounding the game, it is very publicized when you lose those trades now.
That's a really good point. I think for Mike Elias, the prospect hugging without a doubt is an issue. What I will say is, to your point about wanting to win a trade all the time, is I think like Mike shot himself in the foot here. And the reason why I think he shot himself in the foot is like for me, when it comes to trades, it's a process versus results thing. Like, I would never, as a fan, like, put me in the shoes of an Orioles fan. I would rather him shoot his shot and make these trades because he's like, we're all in. We're going to fortify this team. I'm committed to getting this team where it needs to go. Are you going to hit on all those trades? No. But I would rather him go through a solid, thought-out, effortful process and hope for the results than
and
to
leak it
not
to the media or something if you're really worried about it.
Correct. But don't go through no process because you're worried about the result. That can't happen.
Right. Yeah. I think back to like the biggest prospect trades that I think of in the Red Sox system. And it's like Anthony Rizzo was a rookie in the it was in the Red Sox system. And Hanley Ramirez was drafted by the Red Sox. Hanley Ramirez was traded in the Josh Beckett deal. Josh Beckett ended up being, you know, a staple in the Red Sox for a long time. Funny enough, Hanley Ramirez ended up coming back and doing okay way down the road. But like you traded Hanley Ramirez, you got a Josh Beckett, you've sent over a generational shortstop prospect in order to stack up your rotation for a World Series run. Cool. I like that. Nobody talks about that because as nice as it would have been to have Hanley Ramirez, you got a piece that is completely understandable to mortgage a shortstop for a pitcher. Same thing I think about Anthony Rizzo. Anthony Rizzo was traded to the Padres in order to bring Adrian Gonzalez on board. Gonzalez was largely successful with the Red Sox, but what did that give the Red Sox the opportunity to do? Dump the Carl Crawford deal down the road because Adrian Gonzalez was attached to Carl Crawford in order to dump him, what was the other contract that I'm trying to remember? I forget. Anyway, we dumped Adrian Gonzalez down the road.
To the Padres?
No, we traded Gonzalez to the Dodgers along with Carl Crawford to dump the Carl Crawford deal. So what did Anthony Rizzo get the Red Sox is the ability to dump Carl Crawford down the road. But nobody talks about, what would have happened if Anthony Rizzo was a Red Sox. I've never heard that. And it's because you traded a lottery ticket to a team who needed time to build up their roster for a actively performing player right now. If Adrian Gonzalez had gone 0 for 400 in his Red Sox tenure, we would not be talking about it still because he was a known quantity at the time. If you dump prospects for known quantities, it is a very explainable and redeemable trade regardless of whether you lose it or not.
Well, that is the key point there, and I don't understand why Mike Elias is and it's not just Mike Elias. There's other GMs that struggle with this and do the prospect hugging and are afraid to trade prospects. But folks, if you look at the landscape of the game, like you talk about, that's a great example of a good Red Sox trade. Like if you go back 10, 15 years, you saw more MLB for MLB player or MLB level trade. You saw solid MLB player traded for another solid MLB player.
Like now, need for need.
That's few and far. Right. Now that's few and far between. You're only doing prospect level deals essentially now. So you better get used to it. Like, I don't know. There's no other option.
Yeah. It seems like it's always like this guy for cash, this guy for two prospects. Like it's very little. Like I just don't. The Red Sox have a need right now, and I keep going back to the Red Sox. It's just what I know, guys. I'm sorry. They have a need for a first baseman right now, and at this point, it's like, okay, trade one of the plethora of other position players we have for a first baseman. Like, why is Nathaniel Lowe not on my team right now for somebody that, like, yes, it would hurt to get rid of, but also we have somebody in the wings waiting to replace them, and it just doesn't – it sucks. It doesn't make any sense. It's not just a problem with the Orioles, but the Orioles right now are the poster child of it because it's just – that's how the season's shaping out.
You know what? I'm going to be honest with you is I know you guys had a first baseman opening, and I was really excited for you because I was like, this is a chance for Parker to get his boy back. But the Brewers, they freaking signed Bobby Dahl back to a minor league deal. And I was like, damn it, Parker, could have been you. Could have been you.
It's so funny, too, because all the Red Sox beat reporters were like, by the way, White Sox DFA'd Bobby Dahlbeck and Tristan Casas just went down on the same week. And I was like, oh, my God, Bobby's coming back. But it didn't happen.
Bring him home, boys.
I want Nathaniel Lowe. But Ryan Nota was just traded for cash today to the Red Sox. So.
There we go. There we go.
Maybe we can get 23 Ryan Nota back.
Hey, yeah, whatever it takes at this point. I mean, clearly Rafael Devers ain't taking first base. We've established that. So
no, Christian Campbell's on like his second week now of working out at first base in preparation to take over the position. And Marcelo Meyer's been playing second base and AAA the whole time. So
man, oh man. So I guess to wrap up the Orioles conversation, because this is something that we'll continue to follow, two questions for you, Parker. Let's start with the first one. Let's talk about the first one first. Are the Orioles, can we kind of just bury them in the grave? Like it's Memorial Day coming up here next week.
For this season?
Any chance they, is there any chance they turn this around in 25 or are they done?
No, I think they're done. For 2025, I think they're done. They're 10 and a half games back. 10 and a half games back of the wild card, 13 and a half games back in the division. I think it's over.
Oof.
That's a lot. I think the last time we saw a comeback of that level was the Nationals in 2019. And to be fair, they won the World Series, but this lineup could hit at the potential that we see for them for the rest of the season. And I still just don't think it happens. Like, think about that Nationals team and what they were able to accomplish. And also think about the pitching that they had on that roster. It was much better than what's going on in Baltimore right now. I literally think that the Baltimore Orioles are going to have a problem keeping healthy pitchers on the roster because they are going to need to ride mediocre arms to the point where they explode. I think you're going to see a lot of openers. I think you're going to see a lot of bullpen games. I think that they're going to have a very tough time making it through the season. But you know what? Here's the bright side of that. Tyler O'Neill's around for 3 years. You have a bunch of prospects that you can use in the offseason to replace guys like Cedric Mullins, who expected to leave in the offseason. You have developing talent in guys like a Kobe Mayo, like a Jackson Holliday. Gunner's only going to get better, I think. Maybe Ali gets himself out of the funk. If this lineup, like this is just the same conversation we have had for the last 2 years with this team. If this lineup does develop to its full potential, it is a slam dunk division winner with three number three starters in their rotation.
Correct. And I think this becomes a situation where I don't think Oriole fans need to worry about like a rebuild or anything like that. This is at minimum a retool, and it will require Mike Elias or someone just doing the damn thing, just committing, trading away some folks. And you kind of said it earlier, right? You don't need all the guys on your team to be under 23. You know what I mean? Like,
no.
This doesn't have to be the Baltimore Young Bucks here. You know, you can take, dare I say it, but take a Colton Kowser, take a Jordan Westberg, trade him.
Cody Bellinger is going to be a free agent.
Right. Like, if it means you get something really good for those players and you fortify, use, again, a strength to fill a weakness, like, just be bold. Just do it. Like, enough sitting on your hands. Like, I think – I agree with you. I think they're done this year, but it's going to be very interesting to see how bold they are at the trade deadline, and even more so how bold they become in the winter, because one of two things are going to happen, Parker. Mike Elias will not be the GM come the winter, which is a real possibility, or Rubenstein goes to Mike Elias and says, hey, buddy, if you're keeping this job, your ass better be moving starting in September. Like,
you know who I'm on the phone with today is the Pirates.
Theo Epstein. Just kidding.
No, I think I'm on the phone with the Pirates. Yep. Not for Paul Skeens, but for Jared Jones. Yep. Jared Jones is going to miss this season.
Yeah.
He's getting elbow surgery. He's going to miss this season. He'll be back midway through next season. Your window is not opening again. It arguably didn't open, but it's not opening again until, you know, if not next season, the year after. Get a Jared Jones on your roster. Send Grayson Rodriguez to Driveline. Give him a fake injury and send him to Driveline this season and let him figure it out. And supplement your rotation with one more like veteran guy, one more arm that you can bring in. Like, oh God, I'm trying to think of guys that are ready to hit free agency. Like, do the Chris Sale deal that the Braves did with the Red Sox.
Yeah.
Bring in a guy who has a lot of upside, is maybe aging, reaching a point in his career where it's like, are we really going to hang on to this guy and bring him in? Somebody who knows how to win and can teach these young guys how to win. Because so it's kind of the same conversation also with these this Orioles lineup that we have a lot of times in the Red Sox space. Lou Maloney brought it up in just a video he posted on Twitter. The minor league environment for minor league hitters is very selfish. If you're losing a game in the eighth inning with a runner on second, you're losing by one run, you're trying to hit a home run to put your team up, because the home run is what's going to get you called up. There's very little sacrifice bunting, sacrifice flies, things like that in the minor league level, because the whole goal is not necessarily to win the game. It is to inflate your baseball reference page in order to get called up. Their roster, the Orioles roster, is littered with guys who have never once played winning baseball at the major league level and have no clue how to do that. Jackson Holliday's not laying down bunts, at least not programmed into his DNA. No. Right now, he's focused on smashing the ball into the gap. And if a whole team starts to make that transition into, we're going to start playing winning baseball and not necessarily baseball card baseball, then you start seeing a culture start to change. And guys like Tyler O'Neill, Cedric Mullins, even to a certain extent, Adley Rutschman and Ryan Mountcastle on that roster need to start taking leadership roles and coaching these young guys into, this is how you play winning baseball. This is how you win baseball games you were not previously going to win by doing the little things right.
I mean, I'll tell you what, man, those Norfolk Tide games, it's like watching Slugfest Fully Loaded. Less punching the first baseman and Dolphins swinging bats. I mean, I don't understand. Your point is such a good one. They come up and it's an entirely different approach to the game, seemingly. Yeah.
Nobody, listen, you are not going to lose your job by getting sacrifice fly RBIs. You are not going to lose your job or get sent down by bunting the guy over to third base. And it's really hard. And especially like some of these guys literally do not know how to bunt. Right. Like I don't know any of them personally. I haven't seen enough of their baseball to know that. But like sometimes that is an issue that exists. I just watched Seidon Rafael and not be able to bunt somebody over because he's a young guy who just came up through the Red Sox system last year, made his big league debut last year. And then like now he's in this position where he's the nine hitter and is trying to turn the lineup over. And all he's ever tried to do is swing at everything and hit home runs. So this is a problem that doesn't just exist in Baltimore. And sometimes it really just takes into a veteran to get in the head of these guys, not even a hitting coach, but a veteran, to like tap them on the shoulder before they hit the on deck circle and be like, hey, your job's not to get a home run here. Your job's to move the runner over.
100%. 100%. Well, Parker, we'll be following that. We'll be following the Orioles. It's going to be very interesting to see what happens as we get closer to the middle of the season here, and certainly at the end. We'll see what happens, what the future holds for Mike Elias in that front office. Parker, before we get out of here for the night, you know, you're a stat head. I think people know that about you now. You like digging into the numbers and kind of seeing what you can find, and you found some doozies today. So I wanted to kind of give Parker his stat head moment and share with us some interesting things that you found.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was looking at, we almost brought it up the other day on the last episode. We didn't end up getting to it because we ran to like an hour and like 30 minutes or something like that. But Aaron Judge is currently, in case you missed it, he's having like one of the best seasons a right-handed hitter has ever had. To point that out, I want to Aaron Judge carried a 1246 OPS into play today, 48 games into the season. The only other Yankees to do that, to start a season through 48 games since integration in 1947 when Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier. There's two. Mickey Mantle in 1956 carried a 1308 OPS into game number 49. And 1994, Paul O'Neill carried a 1248 OPS into game 49. So I just like, there's a couple guys who have done it, but not many. So Aaron Judge is in rare air right now. If you haven't watched any of his highlights this season, just start doing it because it's very good and it doesn't happen very often. Fun fact though, that 1956 Mickey Mantle season, he had 21 home runs going into game 49 of the season.
Wow. Okay, so question for you, because you've obviously dove into this more than I have. Do you know offhand who has the highest OPS in a season for a Yankee, and can Judge beat that?
Let me look. Give me a second, because I'm going to have to pull this up. But I know, yeah, because I'm now very interested in that.
I mean, you brought it up last week, and I think the point's a fair one. He is putting up one of the better seasons we've seen in history, even beyond his single season home run record, right, for 62 in the American League. So he's, I would say, when you look at the pure hitting clinic that he's putting on this year, this is better than that season. Forget the home runs, like the actual like approach at the plate, decreasing his strikeout rate. He is an all-around better hitter now than he was that season. And I think his OPS number could break some records this year, I would think.
Yeah. No, that's 100% within the realm of capabilities. I'm letting that stat head query. I've got it running right now. I've got it since the integration era, basically all Yankees offensive season, see who comes up with the best OPS. I've got another one, though, and it is that the Red Sox bring 11 blown saves through 51 games in 2025. That puts them on pace for 35 blown saves this season, and only three teams in history since 1947 at integration have done that, and that is your last year, 2024, White Sox with 37 blown saves. The 2021 Nationals had 37 blown saves, and then the only team with a winning record on that list are the 2022 Tampa Bay Rays, who had 36 blown saves but did win 86 games that year.
That is crazy. Okay, so a couple things are coming to my brain here. Number one, huge fan of when anyone asks, like, whose team that did the worst of this in Major League Baseball history? You can always just go to 2024 White Sox, which is such a pleasure in my life. But the second part of this that's interesting is Parker. If the Red Sox keep this up, they're not going to get past 500 this season. This has to really grind your gears.
No, yeah, nope. That's, I'm not going to be a happy camper. I got the query to pull up, but for some reason it logged me out of Stathead, so I couldn't see who it was. So no, it only took a second, so I do want to find this.
Hold on. I want to bring something else up with this too, because this is also some pretty good context here. This is a team, when we talk about that they've blown that many saves already, guys, this is a Red Sox team that has Aroldis Chapman and Liam Hendricks on this damn team.
Mm-hmm.
Like, say what you want about the fact that they're the later of their careers and they've had you know, up and down seasons and whatever. Those are two of the biggest closers in baseball now and over the last several years, and this is what you're getting out of it? Ew.
Yeah, no, especially like Liam Hendricks had some comments over the last couple games. Like, I'm mad about how much I'm actually getting in terms of playtime, and it's like chicken to the egg kind of with him at this point, because what's the problem? Are you not getting appearances because you're not performing, or are you not performing because you're not getting appearances? Like, you're not getting enough work. So it is what it is.
So let me tell you from my experience with Liam Hendricks, seeing him in Chicago, he is 100% that guy. And this is anecdotal, having seen it, is he, the more innings he pitches, the better he is. I have no doubt in my mind about that. So I would bet that that's the way that goes. I would love to see the Red Sox utilize him more frequently. I think you'll get a better result. Is he the same pitcher he was, lights out, like basically Mason Miller level, like 4 or 5 years ago? No. But I think you're going to get a lot better out of him if he's more consistent with innings.
He's a big leaguer. He's a veteran.
Yes.
And that's just kind of, it just kind of is what it is. It's kind of a weird way of doing the search, but I did, over a span of 150 games since 1947, playing for the Yankees in the regular season from the start of the season, every single season since integration sorted by OPS. The top three results are Aaron Judge, Mickey Mantle, and Aaron Judge. Number four is A-Rod. Number five is Aaron Judge.
Wow. Okay, so here's this is how I want to end this. This is the perfect way to end this show. Clip it here. I want everyone to simmer on this. After it's all said and done, Yankees fans are going to hate me for this, I feel like, because they love their boy. I think you know what's coming, and I'm going to milk the shit out of this. Is Aaron Judge, when it's all said and done, when he retires, is he going to be the number one Yankee of all time, even over Derek Jeter?
I don't even know if Derek Jeter is the number one. I think, in my opinion, Mickey Mantle would be the number one. But that's a debate for another day. Are you asking if Aaron Judge completely ends that argument? And it's like, duh, of course it's Aaron Judge.
Yes, because I think there's a lot of asterisks with Babe Ruth. Like, I think we could talk about, Babe Ruth's so great, but I'm going to
bet against Plumbers.
Hot take here. Don't think Babe Ruth was all that great. I'm going to be honest with you. That's just my opinion. But you talk about a Mickey Mantle, you talk about a Derek Jeter for different reasons, of course. But I don't know that you can close the book on saying that Aaron Judge could surpass a Mantle and a Jeter for the greatest Yankee of all time.
I think the three people you look at are Judge, Mantle, and Jeter, just because longevity with the team and then also like peak years with the team. I'll tell you, by OPS, by season OPS, Derek Jeter doesn't appear on this list in the top 10.
No surprise there. Yeah.
So yeah. It's number 11, though. So, like, he's there, but it's Aaron Judge, Mickey Mantle, Aaron Judge, Alex Rodriguez, Aaron Judge, Mickey Mantle, Alex Rodriguez. Like, that's what the top seven looks like. So I think it's Aaron Judge and Mickey Mantle as pertains to hitters. And you know what's funny about Judge, Mantle, and Jeter? I'm pretty sure they're all captains of the team. So, like, I personally believe that in 2025, Aaron Judge has put himself in that conversation of, like, top, definitely on the Rushmore of Mount Rushmore of Yankees, which is, that's nuts, because that's a crazy, crazy list of people to have to pick your Mount Rushmore from.
That is a great, next week, let's do a Mount Rushmore. Not for the Yankees, but I've been dying to do a Mount Rushmore exercise with you. We have to do one.
Okay. Sounds good to me.
All right. Last word, Parker. Do you have a last word for us today?
I'm so excited for this doubleheader tomorrow because I get to watch baseball all day, but that's about it. Good luck to you guys. Appreciate you watching.
Good stuff. My last word today is going to be that I am feeling a little bit better about the White Sox. Honestly, Tim Elko, folks, give a Google to Tim Elko. He's hitting some bombs and he's taking some names, and we got to see him literally in spring training, like 30 feet away from us, Parker.
Yeah.
It was awesome. And I'm a big Tim Elko fan, so that's your homework assignment from Anthony tonight. Go ahead and go see some recent highlights of Mr. Tim Elko.
All 76 OPS points of him.
Calm down, okay?
OPS plus, I'd say.
I know. Listen here. I will literally take anything. The fact that the White Sox are on pace to be even slightly better than 2024 White Sox is a huge victory. I'm taking
that's
it.
A W.
That is a W. All right, folks, you know what to do. If you've been following us here on Late Night Baseball, we greatly appreciate it. But make sure you are subscribing, liking, commenting, sharing with a friend. We love talking baseball each and every week, and we appreciate when you join us. So we'll catch you next week here on Late Night Baseball. Take care, everybody.